Hello and welcome to another episode of the Auto Blog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today in the studio, senior editor for All Things Green, John Snyder. What's up?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon as well. Also in the studio is assistant editor Zachary Palmer. How's it going, man?
Not too bad. How's it going with you?
It's good. It's a Tuesday afternoon. The 4th of July is nearly upon us.
It is.
United States is playing England in soccer right about now, I think.
Yeah.
Anyways, got a great show for you. We're recording this on Tuesday, so we're going to get this out a little bit earlier this week, so you can have it for all your 4th of July travel plans. This week, we're going to talk about the Nissan Murano, the BMW X5. We've been driving those. Pretty cool vehicles, some crossover times here. Also in the news, the Honda E, power figures for that are out. This is this really cool looking, small car that, we saw first as a concept, I believe at the Frankfurt show
yep.
a couple years back. Now it's essentially making it into production in some markets overseas. Man, I wish they'd bring it here. Other topics, Shelby power and price are out. This is for the GT500. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be awesome. It's going to outgun almost everything, but it's also going to be very expensive. Also, there's a hybrid cruise ship out. So we'll talk about that. Lastly, we will spend your money. We got a good one from one of our friends over in the UK. Let's jump right in. All right, guys. Nissan Murano. We had one in the fleet last week. Zach, you and I were just talking at our desks this morning about kind of how we felt about the design inside and out. The Murano had a pretty light redesign, I think, for the 19 model year.
It did.
Yeah, and do you remember what they did to it?
Yeah, so it's almost nothing, actually. Like they changed the front fascia a little. They gave it a little bit more black trim, and the headlights and taillights are LED now. And that's pretty much it for the outside. The inside, you know, the fake wood trim that we were actually talking about before, that's new. For 2019, and they gave it a few safety features as well. Not like a lane keeping assist, but it does have a lane departure assist. It has blind spot monitoring and automatic emergency braking as well. So those are the new features that they gave it for their little mild refresh of 2019.
Sort of like a mild plus refresh on maybe the Taco Bell or, you know, like the Thai food scale. I mean, there's a little bit going on there with some of the tech gizmos. The LED lights, they look the same to me. But yeah. I mean, that's nice. They're finally giving this thing LED lights.
Yeah, the actual look of the lights isn't much different. It's just the fact that they're LEDs instead of halogens now, you know, which is always cool. LEDs always look better. But no, like, doesn't really look like on the inside as though they did a whole lot to try and bring this up to date with the competition. It just doesn't quite pass the muster for like a mid $40,000 crossover for me. The combination of trim, you know, the dark wood trim with the black leather and then this like bright silverish, grayish, weird trim that goes along with it. None of the colors feel like they work together, and none of the patterns actually feel like they work together. It's really hit me in the wrong ways. I don't know if you felt the same way as well about that.
Yeah, so the interior, I think, has always been, in some ways, the shortfalls of this car. It's just, you know, I like the exterior design. I think in 2015, when they rolled this out, this new generation, they took the Murano for being kind of quirky, kind of weird. Some people thought it looked a little bit like the old Subaru Tribeca, if you remember that thing. and I thought this was like almost trendsetting. You know, they were going like sporty crossover at a time when people still were like looking at pretty boxy, pretty traditional SUV-styled crossovers, if you will. So I thought this was a risk. I credit, you know, then Nissan design chief Shiro Nakamura's team for really executing a vision. This is kind of like what the Maxima was looking like at the time. Nissan was really doubling down on like these like aggressive, futuristic designs. And I thought the Murano really like sort of led the way there because you didn't see that in the midsize crossover space. So I generally like the outside. I think now we've got things like the Chevy Blazer, which John hates, but we almost have to have like the Blazer like gut punch in the podcast. Sure. Every time John's on
Fair.
It. I like the blazer, to be fair.
I do too.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good looking. But point being, there's cars like that now, and Volvos and the new Escape, the new Edge. Like, other people are in this field now. So I think Nissan still, I think, is on the edge. You know, they're the leading edge of exterior design. I think, Zach, you've got a slightly different take. But yeah, outside, I think, still looks good. Inside, though, it's like, man, these materials. I mean, the fake wood, it's like so obviously fake. You know, the like obviously fake, like trim, shiny stuff. It's like, it's all blinged out. It's like, it's trying to look super ritzy, but it's like not, you know, I mean, it's like wearing like, I don't even know, you know, it's like, it's just trying so hard. Plus, I think the layout inside is really bad too. Like doing simple things like changing the radio station and turning up the volume, you kind of have to like reach over to do. And I just, the interior is fine, but there's a lot of shortcomings in there.
You know what this car really needs to set itself apart? A convertible top.
I don't think they've thought of that, have they?
That's never been done, right? That's
never been done.
I actually went on the first drive for that car, and I actually liked it. And there are still people around who, you know, are constantly looking for used ones. I guess the market value for used Murano cross cabs is pretty high.
So, I remember seeing one of those at, I think it was the LA Auto Show, 15, 14, whenever they showed that. And I was just standing next to it. Like, I remember talking to another journalist, and he was like, "Could you believe this is a thing?" We were both just kind of standing there, and it's, I agree. If they still sold it, I mean, I feel like there's so many crossover ideas from just a few years ago that it was like, no, we can't do that. We got to be like smart. The economy's tough. We got to stay in our lane. Things that like now might work. Crossover convertible. Yeah. People like crossovers. Sure.
Yeah.
I don't think you're wrong, John. I don't think they were either. They were ahead of their time.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Other thoughts there on this, Zach? I think maybe you like the outside less of the Murano.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sort of in the middle on the exterior styling. I think that cars like the Blazer and the Edge and even the new Honda Passport almost strike me as better exterior designs than this one. There are plenty of curvy, you know, just not too sharp edge crossovers out there. And this is starting to get to the point that it's been out for a few years. It's just starting to blend in with the rest of them out there. And that's sort of how I feel about the driving experience as well. You know, it's a solid 3.5 liter V6, but it's paired to the, you know, sort of lazy CVT transmission. You know, it picks up off the line, and then there's a little dead spot in the middle, and then the revs get up, and then it starts to get a little faster, and it's not, you know, a car that really begs you to hit the gas or anything like that. I think that the 3.5 and the Passport, or the 3.6 and the Blazer, are both better engines as they're paired to traditional automatic transmissions, and it just makes for a slightly more engaging drive, you know, if you go for a car in this midsize crossover segment.
I agree with you. I think in some ways I do look at this vehicle through a little bit of, like, you know, rose-colored glasses. This was one of the like early long-termers we had at Autoblog. Maybe the second year I was here, and I got a lot of time in the car, so I kind of liked it. It had a really light, creamy interior. The interior was bad even then. People's like blue jeans would kind of melt into the like leather. Like, this actually happened over the course of the year. So I have some fond memories of it. It was, you know, it's a big, nice, stylish crossover. The engine's pretty good. CVT is not that great. It's par for the course. That's what I did in my night in the Murano, is I went golfing. So the golf clubs fit in there. I played lights out. I must give myself a plug. I don't know why I had such a good night golfing. I forgot the water, in fact. So I just played like 9 holes in like 90 degree heat, and played great. And maybe the Murano had something to do with it. It probably didn't. Anyways, we should probably move on from this, get over to the X5. Just drove that, last night. Definitely enjoyed driving it, but let's tee things up with John, who did the first drive back last fall. You had the whole lowdown on this vehicle, so kind of break it down again for us.
All right. So yeah, I drove it in Atlanta under a bunch of different conditions, but you know, it's got the turbo inline six, 335 horsepower, 300 pound feet of torque, 8-speed auto. This was the xDrive 40i that I drove. It was nice. I really liked pretty much everything about it except for one thing, and that was the steering. When you were on any sort of like curvy road, the steering just feels super vague, and it's hard to sort of place it in the lane. I felt like I was sort of drifting to the edge of the road. Just felt really numb and not very responsive, and a little like floaty and drifty. But everything else about the car, I loved it. I took this thing off road. It was on, you know, all season tires. It was fantastic off road, which really surprised me. I mean, I don't think many X5 owners are going to actually do that with this, but it's pretty cool to know that it can. It has tons of cool little features like the load leveling suspension and stuff like that. And it does a lot of things really well. I just did not like the steering. I think that would maybe make this a deal breaker for me.
And, you know, I am actually right there with you on the steering. The first time I drove this, it felt like a steering system that I had never felt before on any other kind of car. And I came back and looked it up on BMW's website, and it's something that they call integral active steering. They've actually used it on other BMWs previous to this X5, but this is the first time that any kind of an X crossover vehicle has had it. To quote the BMW website, what this does is the system has the additional effect of increasing straight-line driving comfort by actively countering the vibrations triggered by bumps on one side of the road. So what it does is it puts these little weird impulses into the steering, and it's not something that you're used to. And it's supposed to make it more comfortable. And, mm-hmm. you know, I did think that the driving on the highway was, you know, it may have been, you know, slightly less bouncy through the steering wheel. You don't feel as much through there. But, you know, at the same time, I was thinking to myself, like, this is a BMW. You're not buying the Mercedes GLE. You're not buying the Audi. Maybe I want a little bit of that steering feel. You know, and, you know, it's just those thoughts that you go through. But at the same time, it's still a luxury crossover, and you get all those great things that you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. One neat tech feature that I saw on this one, it has BMW's backup assistant, which I actually tried out on my own driveway. It's pretty neat. It remembers the previous 55 yards.
That's right.
That you drive, and then you can just get in the car, press the little BMW backup assistant button, and it'll actually back down your driveway or back out of whatever crazy thing you've decided to pull the car in for you. And it worked. It works up to 55 yards. After 55 yards, the system kind of just stops doing anything. So you have to pay attention, like, okay, like we've made it this amount of time, because it was actually starting to like back up into the grass on my driveway. I was like, okay, yeah. All right. Time to take over. But but for that short amount there, it's really cool what they can do there. You know, you can park your car kind of in this ridiculous area where it might be super difficult to back out of. And
right.
Boom, you just hit this button and it retraces the steps and does it perfectly.
Yeah, and that's really cool. I didn't get a chance to use that, but that's a really cool feature to have in a large vehicle like that. You know, that's the worst part about driving big cars for me is just... I hate parking lots, you know. I hate trying to park them. I hate the just maneuvering them in tight spaces is, you know, inevitably it's something that has to happen. Luckily here in Michigan we've got a little more space, you know, some bigger lots but you know, for a lot of people in cities or whatever, that's going to be super helpful.
What I liked about this one, this was the one that we had in the office, is the X5, X50i. So that gives you the twin turbo V8. So that's a really strong motor. I think you guys, when you get through it, you're going to like that. I really like the styling of the X5, and I think sort of by extension, I also like it on the X7 and the X3, you know, cause they're basically what size of BMW SUV would you like? But I would argue that the X5 is the most well-tailored of the group. I feel like when you look at the rear haunches, that really like large BMW kidney grille, the badges, they all just kind of hang properly on the X5. The X7 seemed a little barge-like to me. The X5 seemed a little bit, it just seemed like this is how it was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. X3 is a little bit small. I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But for me, the looks of this thing are really strong. I think this is like, it reminds me of some of the great 5 and 7 series, like during their true heydays. Like when I pulled up at this thing, like, I mean, you really feel like you're arriving in this, like, you know, really imposing car. And this has the 21-inch M wheels on it. They're kind of like wiry, like spoky sort of things. Yeah. It looks really sweet, I think. The interior is very nice. BMW's infotainment system, I think, is pretty usable. I like the rotary knob, the way you could toggle back and forth. I mean, to me, the litmus test is, how easily can you switch from satellite radio to FM and AM? And like, there's some vehicles we've tested that it's just bloody impossible to do that. You know, this is pretty simple. You know, you can pair your phone. It's entirely usable.
And if I'm not mistaken, this is a new generation of the infotainment system.
It is, correct.
Showing up in the X5. And it definitely does seem improved and streamlined since iDrives of yore.
Yeah, no, I especially like this new iDrive because it's touchscreen compatible. You know, the old one was you had to use the little rotary and sometimes it could get frustrating. But this one is, you know, you can use the rotary. It works great. Or you could just use it like a traditional touchscreen and it's a huge, I think it might be a big 12-inch screen and it's super usable. But one thing you mentioned there is that, you know, we have the one with that 4.4 liter V8 in the office. I haven't driven that one yet. I drove the same one as John with that 3-liter inline six. That was an awesome engine. You know, it made all the right inline six noises. So I'm really excited to try out that V8.
BMW, I think, is in a pretty strong place, along with Mercedes with its engines. They're developing some interesting, you know, displacements. Yeah. You know, they're both going back to straight sixes, which I think is great for us to see. Fully endorse that move. But I mean, hey, twin turbo V8, I wasn't actually expecting it. I was like, oh, this is just the X5. Wait a minute. This is the X50. Wait a minute. That's the big one, the big engine. Sweet. So it's got some get up. Let's put it that way. I was on the expressway and definitely, you know, kind of flying in front of people. You know, it's good for merging. When you need a little bit of extra sort of steam. Bad news, it does have IAS, though, guys. I hate to break it to you. it's a thing, you know. I don't know if there's a way you cannot get it.
Right.
But I was not as offended with the steering. I can see your points, though. Like, it feels a little odd at times. But I also felt like around town, like, just, you know, short. I have a fairly short commute. Steering's pretty connected. I think, you know, for me, I was like, this feels about like what I was kind of expecting. I also, in an X5, I'm going to have a different thought process than I would in, say, an M5 or a regular 5 series or a 3 series. So for me, I was just like, okay, you know, it is what it is. It's fine, you know. I think most X5 buyers would probably be in that same sort of, you know, field. They wouldn't be super offended. Some of the hardcore BMW loyalists might be, but that's okay.
For whatever reason, I found the X7 easier to drive. And that might just be because I was driving it in the city and on the highway, on the freeway. Whereas the X5, I was on like these rural sort of hilly roads where in steering, you have to be a little more precise. But I want to try this V8 version now, though. Sounds pretty cool.
I filled out my score sheet. I won't reveal precise scoring. This is for our Autoblog scores, for our editor's picks sort of things. But I like this. I gave this pretty high marks on a scale from 1 to 10. I had this, I'll say this was over 7, let's put it that way, which is pretty solid for us.
Yeah.
I gave it a 7.6. I might revise that by the time, you know, we have our meeting for this next week, which I might even round up to an 8. I really liked it. The motor for me was really a strong selling point. The looks were really strong. Looking across, you know, organically, the X5 range, the inline six, I haven't driven that lately, but it's a brilliant engine. So I don't think that's going to, you know, dissuade me in any sense. Again, I like the interior. I'm excited about this. We've been driving a few SUVs sort of in this segment lately, and I've been finding it really tough to figure out which ones I would recommend as an editor's pick and which ones I wouldn't, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, to me, this one falls on the side of editor's pick, but hey.
Yeah, for me we'll too. See. For me too. It does everything except for steering so well. Yeah. So yeah. Well.
I'm really excited to drive the new Mercedes GLE. You know that.
Me too. That's what I've been really thinking about all day in the back of my head.
Yeah, that has that super trick. The air suspension that actually leans into curves. You know, yeah, that's gonna be a fun one to drive. So that it'll be that versus the X5. I'm not sure. Maybe the engine in the X5 will take it over the Mercedes, or maybe the luxury of the Mercedes and that trick suspension will do it. I'm not sure yet. So
cool. So we'll move along from the X5. I think, you know, very interesting vehicle. Also interesting. This is a good story, for all of you green fans out there, written by Zach Palmer. But I know, John, you've got some strong opinions on this. This is the electric Honda E, some new photos, the power figures are out. Why don't you just really quickly give us the 30-second microwave version of what's new there, Zach?
Yeah, so Honda's been just trickling out new information, you know, month by month. And new today, we learned that it has 148 horsepower and more than 221 pound-feet of torque. So we don't know how heavy the car is yet, but with electric torque happening, you know, all that coming on right from the start, you know, this is probably going to be a pretty quick little city car.
Yeah, it's not bogged down with a huge battery. It doesn't have as much range as, you know, some of the compact hatchbacks that are coming out here now, but you know, I don't think that's necessary. But yeah, that will improve, you know, the power to weight ratio for sure.
Absolutely. And one other bit that Honda revealed here is a turning radius of just 14 feet. That is, you know, an absolutely astounding turning radius to me. You know, we tested a Smart 4.2 electric drive, I think it was like last year or the year before. And so a smart car, like it's about as small as they get, that has a turning radius of 22.8 feet.
Wow.
So this doesn't just like slightly beat it. This absolutely demolishes that turning radius.
So for perspective, roughly how big is this car? It's like, how big is this thing?
I'd have to look up the exact figures, but man, I mean, I would estimate, you know, it about a foot smaller than a Fit or
gotcha.
So,
okay.
So just kind of picture a Honda Fit and just chop like a foot or maybe a little even more than that off of it.
Okay. I mean, that's a pretty small car. I think, I mean, my gut take is they could sell this car here and it could be a winner.
I
think bring it here, make this the ultimate city car. You know, I don't think people want to drive these weird, like weird borderline golf cart motorcycle things. I think they want a legitimate car, but they want it to be small. And if you live in New York or Chicago or Los Angeles or, you know, Detroit as the downtown continues its resurgence, you need a car like this. You can't drive a Chevy Suburban. I truly think something like this that's styled this cool would do well. And the other thing is, like, everybody doesn't have to be like everything to all people. Sell it on the coasts. Do that. Sell it in Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver or something. You know, like hit the niche markets, or not the niche, but like the targeted markets, and do that. I mean, I've really liked this thing since I remember like writing the post on very early, like September of like 17. Does that sound right? For that Frankfurt show. And I remember looking at this picture thinking, this thing's awesome. They got to do this. And I'm glad they are. But I just think there's a market for it here. I think maybe even find a way to stretch it like half of a foot. I don't know. Just get it somewhat to be a little less, you know, this small in simple terms. But I think it could work. And I think it's also a situation where eventually gas prices are going to go back up. And we're going to, like, people are going to want to drive stuff like this. We have driven really small cars here in the past. I don't know if it's realistic to expect it to crash legally, right, if you will. I don't know if that could meet federal specifications, but if it could, I think it could be compelling.
Yeah, I think that's part of the deal. That's what I've heard anyway. Yeah, Honda designed this for Europe, and I think they shot themselves in the foot a little bit by doing that specifically and not, you know, having an eventuality of bringing it over to the U.S. Because, yeah, if you design it for this, specifically for the certain market, and then it can't pass our crash tests, and you find that, you know, it takes off in Europe and everyone loves it, and you just can't sell it anywhere else, that sucks, man. But Honda has said that they've got something else in the works for the U.S. I just wish it was this, you know? No, I don't want something else. I want this.
Exactly.
Yeah, I really wish that they'd bring it here. You know, if I wanted an electric car, you know, without even driving this, I would want to buy this car. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more of an emotional purchase than anything, too. I mean, it's a fun rear-wheel drive car. It has good power. It's going to handle great.
Yeah.
50-50 weight distribution. You know, one barrier, I think, you know, for it actually selling well in the U.S. would be price. You know, right now, Honda hasn't released a price, but, you know, estimates are around like 30,000 British pounds, which converted to U.S. dollars, it's nearing 40 grand before options. And of course,
Honda, before a tax credit.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, Honda would get that $7,500 tax credit, but that's still over $30,000 for a car that's smaller than a Fit, which, for me, I wouldn't mind, but it's just, it could be a tough sell.
If I lived like, John, you're from Ann Arbor, say I lived there and I had some nice loft and I walked a good amount of time and I just needed wheels and I wanted them to be sustainable and most of my driving was just around downtown Ann Arbor, I'd look at this, or downtown Detroit or New York, sure. And then when I wanted to go do my outdoorsy stuff, I mean, I'd figure something out. I don't know if that means I'd buy like an old Blazer or something. I don't know. That is sort of defeating the purpose of being environmentally friendly is you have one really green car and then you drive a tank to go like, you know, golfing in. I don't know. But I don't know. I don't have the business case for it, but I think it's a cool car.
Yeah, I agree. And I hope to get over to Europe to drive it at some point.
Yeah.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
I think you just brought up a really good idea. That's like what we should do is go to Europe and drive this thing.
Yes.
Maybe at the next, there's a Frankfurt Motor Show this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm about to head off to the Goodwood Festival of Speed. I hope that Honda at least has one there to see.
Yeah, you know, that'd be cool.
I've never seen it in person before. It just looks so good in pictures.
Yeah. This is like the Suzuki, I'm forgetting it, the Jimny. Mm-hmm. That's another thing it's very small, but I think they could sell it here.
Yeah.
Targeted markets. I think some of these things, they're not like, they're selling Americans short and thinking the only thing we want to drive is like enormous battle cruiser SUVs. And it's like, there's a time and a place for that. It's a big country. There's no question. But in certain situations, this could work, you know, and that's where I keep looking at, you know, why and how some of these other companies could be, you know, succeeding. So anyways, let's really throw a hard fade here. We're going to talk about the Shelby, but here's just a random news story this week. Reuters moved it. The next hybrid, how about a cruise ship?
Yeah.
This is coming out of Norway. It's battery powered, going to sail for the Arctic, which, cool, it's awesome. You got to check this out. We got pictures of it on our site. It's pretty cool looking. I mean, it's, you know, definitely how would you picture your stereotypical like large cruise liner? It's named after a Norwegian explorer who did the Northwest Passage back over 100 years ago, first to reach the South Pole back in 1911. Let's see, I got the name in front of me. It is where is the name of this thing? The Roald Amundsen. I'm probably saying that wrong.
I was going to say that's better than I could have done.
Yeah. So, I mean, anyways, the point though is this is a cool idea. I think we should do more of this stuff. I mean, it's kind of awesome, you know? I mean, for a full breakdown of how this actually works, definitely read the story on our site. But I love the concept here.
Yeah, it can go, it says it can go 45 to 60 minutes on batteries alone, which, I mean, that's not a ton, but I mean, that's something. And anything that you can do to reduce the emissions of ships like this is hugely important. I read an article from Fast Company last month about how Carnival's cruise ships pollute more than all of Europe's cars, which
that's
is kind of
mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And, you know, that's where a large portion of our carbon and other emissions come from are ships, whether it's cruise ships or shipping. So yeah, anything that goes toward, you know, reducing that is definitely good. And I would love to, like, I would do this just to support it, you know, just to support this idea. I think it'd be fun. I'd probably be pretty geeked out about being on a cruise on this hybrid ship.
Probably be pretty quiet, at least for the parts the batteries are going.
Well, yeah, you could get into, like, into the fjords and, you know, turn off the diesel or whatever motor and, you know, putter around quietly around the wildlife, and, you know, you won't be, you know, affecting whales and their migration and stuff with that, the echolocation that they use. And so, yeah, I think it's a really cool idea, and it's a necessary one.
Yeah, the sheer size of this hybrid ship sort of blows my mind too. Like, how many batteries, how large is the battery pack that it's able to go for an entire hour like this? You know, there's that. And this also makes me think, like, you know, airplanes, you know, they definitely put out a lot of pollution as well. You know, when is that going to be possible? Obviously, you throw a lot more weight into an airplane and it's tougher to get off the ground.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a massive source of pollution that, you know, we could possibly hybridize. I'm not sure about the technicalities of the technology there, but it sounds like a good idea in my head.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell you what, they're going to deliver another one of these ships next year. I'm not sure if this is like a sister ship or what this is, but companies working on another one that's going to have a battery pack with twice the capacity of this one. So they're already like making progress, which I think is a great thing. Also, this is like a way better idea than the people who thought, hey, let's rebuild the Titanic. Have you guys heard about that?
No.
Yeah, there's a Titanic clone that they're building.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like a disaster.
Yeah, I just saw...
I see what you did there, John. But yeah, I mean, this is just like... Yeah, I think this is just a really forward-looking idea.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yep.
Cool. All right, let's talk about the Shelby before this podcast comes off the rails here. yeah, numbers are out. This thing looks and sounds like it's going to be awesome. More expensive, though, than some of its competitors, like the Hellcat. I believe the ZL1, too, Zach. Price tag comes in at just under 74 grand. Take it away.
Yeah, so... You know, this is obviously going to be the best, fastest Mustang ever, and it's also going to be, you know, pretty much more money than you could spend on any other Mustang, too. And that comes as no surprise. This thing is going to be freaking awesome when we actually do get to drive it. One of the things that probably shocked us the most was the carbon fiber option that comes in at $18,500.
That's amazing. That's crazy.
Incredible. Like
$18,500.
That Ford is offering an option on a Ford Mustang for $18,500.
The base price, for the record, is just under like 27, somewhere in there, of the regular Mustang.
Yeah. For just a base EcoBoost coupe, you know. So this is about 70% of that base EcoBoost coupe.
And or like a used 14 Mustang or something. I'm my mind is blown here.
Yeah. But yeah, no, you get super cool Barocarbon 20-inch wheels.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You get
that's amazing.
Michelin Pilot Sport Cup tires. You get the massive GT4 track wing, which is right off of the Mustang race car. You get a special splitter with an integrated dive plane and the front splitter wickers. They also take the rear seat out for you.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. You know, you get a little less weight.
Dodge Demon style.
Yeah. Nice. Who doesn't love carbon fiber wheels either. I think those look way too cool. When those came out on the GT350, I thought that they were the coolest wheels on the market. And they're doing it again for the GT500, so I love it.
Yeah, they do look awesome. I'm looking at the photos right now. They're super cool.
I think right now when I look at the three, your choices, like Hellcat, ZL1, or this, I'm going with this probably. It just looks so awesome. It might be a little insane to drive, though, as far as just daily driving. This might sound crazy, but the Hellcat, like with an automatic, is will not kill you in
right.
some ways.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's surprisingly docile when you yeah. want it to be.
Yeah. So, I mean, but the front end, those like, I would almost call them like chin straps on the side. In the way, like, the Cobra is right in the middle. This thing looks awesome. I've always been a GT350 guy. I always kind of thought GT500, I mean, it sounds awesome, but it's also maybe a little bit much. How much horsepower do you need? It's a Mustang. Yep. 350 is more like the right size. Well, holy cow, man. This thing looks awesome.
Yeah.
No, I totally agree with you. If I was, you know, having to decide between, like, a Hellcat Red Eye, this, or a ZL1 or ZL1 1LE, I would 100% take the Mustang. You know, it's I've driven the GT350, and if this has the same driving dynamics and, you know, just that much more power, and if it's manageable, you know, which is a different goal that they've had for this versus the old GT500, which was just, you know, 667 horsepower of pure American muscle and not much else. You know, this is supposed to be a truly track capable Mustang, and I love that. I would absolutely take this over all the competition, I think.
What about you, John?
I don't know. I'm a big fan of the Hellcat Red Eye. I think if I were picking right now without having driven this Mustang, I would go with the Hellcat. But I will reserve final judgment until I get a chance to drive this.
It's interesting. No Camaro fans in this room. I like the ZL1, but I also think the ZL1's a little bit much.
Yeah, no, like if I could see out of the Camaro, I would probably take the Camaro, honestly. But
It drives really sharply.
It drives. I think that, you know, the Camaro in its, you know, its 1LE trims, I think it actually is a better chassis and handles better than the Mustang and is more fun to drive from that perspective. But I just can't get over that super cramped, you know, you're kind of almost in a little hole when you're sitting in the Camaro.
Driving your own coffin.
Yeah, and I like the feel of the Mustang that much more that I'd buy it over the Camaro. So.
Interesting. I think, it's a tough one. But yeah, I think I might go Shelby at this point. We'll see, though. I'm excited about this car. I think anytime there's a new Shelby, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I remember one time I interviewed Carroll Shelby a few years back. Obviously, it's been a few years. The late Carroll Shelby. And I remember I asked him, like, hey, man, what's your, I don't think I said man, I think I said, like, sir. It's like, what's your favorite of all the cars you've built? And he looked at me and he goes, the next one. So I think that kind of speaks to, like, how he rolled and how I think
that's cool.
Like, you know, the creed of Shelby is, you never stand still, always one better. So, yeah, I mean, you get to do some cool things in this gig. And interviewing Carroll Shelby in a theater in downtown LA is pretty cool, and having a few beers and remembering it. So, looking forward to this car, though, that's for sure. I think, I just can't get over how mean the front end looks.
Yeah.
But how about we spend some money?
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So this is, let me just pull this up right here. So this is a really cool one, written from Michael, one of our friends over in Oxford in the UK. So thanks for listening and thanks for writing. We really appreciate that. This is a great spend my money. Looking for a family-friendly convertible in the UK. So I've adjusted the budget accordingly. But this means some like older Mustang convertibles, he doesn't have access to stuff like that. So price range is, he's looking at $20,000, top limit of about 50,000 miles. Previous car, Jaguar XF, X-Kate convertible, some Miatas, Lotus Elise.
That's awesome.
Alfa Romeo, Spider, lots of hatchback diesels. We could like literally do a photo gallery of this guy's fleet of cars he's had in his life. Yeah. This is awesome. Needs a reliable. It's got to fit a growing 5-year-old. That's pretty awesome too. I think props that you want to maintain a sporting kind of lifestyle. Also needs room for his wife and has a 10-mile commute on back roads with fast dual lanes. Wow, that's this just guy sounds like he's living right.
Yeah.
So the choices are 2013 Golf GTI Cabrio, 2014 Mini Convertible JCW, liking these, 16 Mini Convertible S, BMW 2 Series, that's from 15, 2014 Audi A3 1.4T, or the 2016 Fiat Abarth 595. Which of these do you guys like, and is he missing anything?
So the thing that jumps to me, you know, needs reliable. I'm not sure how reliable a lot of these cars are going to be, actually. You're looking at a lot of used British and German cars, and one Italian one. So, you know, newer might be better for reliable, but at the same time, I'm really drawn to that Golf GTI Cabriolet. That's a really unique car. Obviously, we don't get it in the U.S. here, but the fact that you have access to a GTI with a convertible, you know, is really awesome. So, you know, with that, you get all the great GTI things, and I think you also get a pretty practical back seat, too.
Yeah.
So that's going to be great for your growing five-year-old. And, you know, it's a ton of fun to wind down on a back road. It's not rear-wheel drive like that BMW 2 Series is, but I think it's still going to be a lot of fun to drive. So that would probably be the one. I'd just get the nicest GTI Cabriolet that I can get within your budget. That would be my choice.
Yeah, I'm drawn to, and this is similar sort of thinking, I'm drawn to that Audi A3. For similar reasons. But yeah, the GTI stands out. I just don't know what some of the other options would be. You know, not living in the UK. But yeah, definitely from this list, I don't know. It's tough because that 2 Series is going to be really fun too. I don't know if that's quite as practical as the Audi or the Golf, but gosh, it's cool. Yeah, I'm going to go with the A3. That's what I would pick.
So at first blush, A3 was my pick. As I look at this, I think I would also strongly look at the 2 Series just because I think the rear-wheel drive chassis, and I like the 2 Series. I think it's a pretty fun car to drive. Yeah. Those would be my top two. I mean, it's, you know, the convertibles, the mini convertibles, especially the JCW and the Golf GTI, that's, I forgot that thing existed. I mean, that's just such a cool thing. You guys are so lucky to have that. That would certainly be enjoyable, engaging, you know, blasting through the British countryside. That sounds kind of like an amazing life. My pick would be 2 Series, though. I got to pick one. That's how I'd land. So 2 Series, Golf GTI, convertible, A3?
A3.
All right.
But I could be convinced of 2 Series or GTI, but not the other ones.
I'm also weirdly drawn to that JCW. You know, I think it's
same here.
It might be like the most fun choice of all of them. Like, I really really love driving any JCW I'm in, and you know, it won't be great for backseat space or anything like that. But if you're just looking for pure fun, that might actually be the choice on the list.
Yeah, I could see that. I think this is a pretty fun list. So, yeah. Michael, let us know what you end up picking. We would love to hear how this turns out. Yeah, thanks for writing. And to everybody else, thanks for listening. Have a great and safe holiday out there. Happy 4th of July. For John, Zach, I'm Greg. We'll see you next week.